like show business.
I'm John DeSando.
And I'm Carolyn Brock, and you're listening to It's Movie Time.
Carolyn, they're in for it for an hour.
I know. Hold on, everyone. If you're listening, it's going to be a long go. But trust me, it's worth it.
Sure is, because we're looking at Docs and Nearly Dead Dudes of 2012.
What a title. So here's how we came up with this. John, no doubt, 2012 was a year of the documentary. So many great documentaries. So we thought, hey, we've got our Docs. And what goes with Docs?
Oh, Nearly Dead Dudes.
Exactly right. Yeah. We were looking over the list of the movies we've seen for 2012, and the one thing that stood out was, man, there are a lot of really old dudes.
What really stood out was our affinity for alliteration. So we've got enough D's in there, we've got a topic. Then we had to figure out after that what happened.
Well, okay, so you gave away our secret. So this is all tongue-in-cheek, so if anyone has a problem saying Nearly Dead Dudes, John?
Oh, boy.
These are your peers, right?
These are. I feel some kind of an affinity with these people.
So let's start with Docs, because the documentary really took the cake this year, and that's going to be interesting heading into, you know, the awards season. We've got the Golden Globe nominations, but I'm curious as to how the Academy Awards are going to deal with this, because so many documentaries, in my opinion, could be Best Picture nominations.
Now, what we've selected here are docs that we particularly like. Here are some docs that we really thought we need to discuss with you. First one is Bully.
Wow.
And that'll be good reason, as you can tell, when we discuss it.
Exactly right.
Samsara.
Right. Ball Player.
Oh,
Pelotero.
Yes, yes. Oh.
And Imposter, which is knock 'em out. If you haven't seen this movie, man, you're going to want to see it.
And maybe our favorite, for a variety of reasons, The Queen of Versailles.
Oh, or Versailles, as the queen in the movie likes to say. Make Believe, which really, I think, goes hand in hand with Bully.
Yes, it does. It does. And then finally, one that I just saw called Chasing Ice.
And this is about climate change.
Let's go back to Bully.
Okay. This movie, I think, has really shaped 2012 and really is such a social commentary on what is happening in schools throughout the country, throughout the world. I walked into the movie and within, I will say, 15 seconds, I was completely and totally in tears. And it didn't stop for the entire movie. What a touching film. What an important film. And really, this is the year for this movie. It couldn't have come at a better time.
Sure. Two of the kids in this movie committed suicide. So it captured itself some very poignant moments.
It gives you this firsthand look at the absolute pain and just how tough it is to be a kid these days.
And there are quite a few interviews as well as situations with the bullied kids. And in my criticism of it, there's no discussion of bullies or any possible remedies for it. So I see that as a limitation for bullies.
But, you know, that really is what a documentary is all about. It's supposed to show you what is happening and not do it in a way that's interjecting.
I know. But I mean, you wouldn't even inquire from any psychologists about what they've learned.
That is an important part. But I do think, you know, the reason why this movie did make our list for this year, it's getting everyone to talk about it. I saw this movie. I felt like I had a responsibility to do something. You know, I think if everybody sees a film like this, and if you haven't seen it, I say as painful as it is to watch, you have to go and watch and you have to see this and you have to go through the motions of seeing something that is so awful in order to do something about it.
Yeah, when you hear one of the bullied students say this, you'll understand why we were so moved. He says, "I've never had real friends that would stick around and help me." This kind of statement brings home pathetic nature of our ability to even protect them. We have a camera on the bus.
Right.
This.
And even so, there's no protection. And there's a scene in this movie, and I think this really got to the heart of the issue, where you see the principal in this school, and this poor kid is getting in trouble for trying to stick up for himself against a bully. This kid is begging for the principal to listen to him and to do something about it. She puts it back on this kid who's being bullied and says, if you didn't do that, he wouldn't do that to you. Obviously, this is just one case and one moment in time, but I think this is something that has happened in schools all across the country. And I will say, as someone who has, I'm an aunt to little ones, a 7 and a 5-year-old, I am so vigilant and I ask questions. And I think it's because of this movie that I am so protective and I really want to know. So I ask them, and not in a way that doesn't scare them, but I want to know what's going on. Sure. Are you being nice? Are people being nice to you? I think it's an important thing. And I think this movie really showed a side to America and a side to schools that is hard to see, but important.
This is a Weinstein Weinstein produced film.
And the Weinstein brothers, man, did they have some movies this year?
Yeah, and this was originally given an R by MPAA.
Right.
Weinstein's fought it and eventually expunged some of the F-bombs, although they were allowed to keep in a particular section. Because while there are expletives in here, they're so germane to what's going on in the abuse.
Right.
But anyway, that's how interesting a movie it is.
And, you know, the Drexel, I will say, hats off to the Drexel, because the Drexel Theater in Bexley did what an amazing job trying to get this movie out there. Had school kids day in and day out coming into the theater to watch this. Had a panel, you know, education professionals to sit and discuss the problem. So the Drexel has been, I mean, what a year for the Drexel to be able to do this and to not only just, you know, they added the part, John, I think you were missing from the documentary, is let's talk about how to, to find solutions.
Right.
So great for the Drexel.
That's got the earmarks of Jeff Franks.
Exactly.
Programming.
So good for him.
And let me end by giving you another quote.
Of course.
A bullied student says, pretty much a good day for me would be people leaving their hands off of me.
Oh.
All right. Can we have a happier film?
I mean, we need to.
All right. Let's go to Samsara.
Okay.
Samsara. And this is a completely visual movie. There is no dialogue. So for those of you who saw Koyana Scott,
I was going to say The Artist.
No, well, okay. But this one, of course, is a, well, in a sense, a document. And it begins with Buddhist monks and ends with Buddhist. And you have there the kind of mandala that's being created by the monks and then destroyed by them, this beautiful creation in sand. And throughout then you have the contrast, in some sense, a visual contrast between the beauty and endurance of nature and mankind's ability to destroy and not to create anything as permanent, for instance, as Monument Valley, for instance, in northern Arizona and Utah, all those beautiful rocks. So within that, you have images contrasting.
And this was one of your favorites?
This is indeed one of my favorites because it shows me what film can do without sound. It has beautiful music accompanying, but without that narration, because film is so spectacularly visual.
I don't know. I think I've been with kids a lot. So to think of watching something that didn't have sound, I just think it would have been impossible.
Well, you know, among other things, you have a Gothic cathedral and you have the camera going all through the cathedral. And then you have a troupe of Balinese dancers imitating a many limbed goddess to suggest eternity. So you have all kinds of these beautiful images in colors that are blinding.
As I understand it, the whole documentary is dealing with life and death and nature. And
exactly.
So I think it's one of these ones where, of course, we need to see it.
Yeah.
But life and death, let's get on to Ball Player, because this is life and death for kids in the Dominican Republic.
Yes, it's called Ball Player Palatero.
So this made our list of docs because we weren't expecting much, John, you and I, when we saw this. Afterwards, we couldn't stop talking about the just kind of the nature of the business. I had no idea Major League Baseball was so unbelievably invested in farming. And when I say farming, I really mean farming these young, young kids in the Dominican Republic.
More than you would expect of players from the Dominican Republic. And this will show you why, because it's a real business down there. And what you're talking about are poor families who are looking to be lifted out of poverty by being selected on a particular day in July to play Major League Ball.
Independence Day, as they say.
Yes.
And the thing to me that's so interesting is the standards. This movie just opens up the standards of what a ball player is supposed to be like. If you're American, if you're 18, that's fine. 18 is young to be drafted,
that's
to be
right.
into the system. If you are over the age of 16 in the Dominican Republic, you are past your prime. Every year you get less and less and less money. So this movie has intrigue. It has suspense because there's something that happens where is someone lying about their age in order to get more money.
Very little accurate record keeping, which
for a good reason, right?
Right. Which of course, when people are vetting all of this, it rises to the surface. Is this kid really 16 or not? As we know from one of the characters here, that's the difference between being drafted or not drafted.
Right. This documentary follows the life of these kids on their journey. And for them, it's not even about getting to the major leagues. It's about getting to this day in July where they find out if they can get the money to rise out of poverty.
That's what it's all about.
And
is the
beyond
money.
That is not. So you see how invested the Major League Baseball is. What they have one office in the United States in New York, and then the rest is all focused on the Dominican Republic. So you have trainers, you have ball clubs, agents, and then these kids and their families. So it follows the lives of these kids as they really try to to change their own lives and the lives of everybody around them.
One of the trainers says something that I think summarizes what we're trying to say about the drama of this documentary. Here's what he says. It's like when you go and harvest the land, you put the seed in, water it, and when it grows, you sell it.
And that's exactly what is going on there. And you think about it, and you know, sports in general is such a, it really is a topic where people just like to see, lifting the veil, what really goes on behind the scenes. And you see this, and these are kids, and they are training every single day for hours and hours and hours, and many of them never make it.
That's real. Let's talk about something that has an unreal quality about it.
And John, I think the imposter, we're going to talk about imposter now. This is my favorite documentary of 2012. This follows this guy. And it's so weird because you have to see this movie. First of all, you must see Imposter. I don't know how you can avoid it because it is one of these movies that it will stay with you.
And you will talk about it afterwards. Guaranteed.
It is the best conversation generator ever. So
in 1994.
Right.
A 13-year-old San Antonio boy, Nick Gibson, vanishes. And then all of a sudden, somewhere in Europe,
he appears.
He reappears. And what do you know? How glorious. Family embraces him. It's wonderful.
Here's the problem. The Nick who disappeared, blonde hair, blue eyes, never left Texas. The Nick who says he's Nick has a very strong French accent, dark hair and dark eyes. It looks nothing like this Nick, but everybody,
the family uncritically accepts the lost child. It's a couple of years later.
This guy has a full on beard, would need to shave like multiple times a day. This documentary is done in such an interesting way because the guy who is the imposter, who pretends he is Nick.
Wait, no, he tells us right off that he's the imposter. So don't we not reveal
no.
anything here?
He says, this is how I scammed this family.
But you might say to yourself, what is it with that family that they're so accepting?
And there's something much, much darker yes. and sinister going
and
on
you
here.
You need to see it to ask those questions as to how does this guy, who's so different from the kid who vanished, how does he convince them that he's family?
Here is a guy who has made, and this wasn't, we find out throughout the course of this, and I'm not giving anything away, but we find out throughout the course of this that this guy has done this multiple times. This isn't his first rodeo, so to speak, fooling and tricking people. But it's the interesting part is when this guy, who is a con man, a professional con man, this is what he does for a living, when he all of a sudden becomes afraid for his life and afraid yes. about who the kind of people he's tricked, and instead of him being the aggressor right. and him being the predator, he feels like there is at some point he could be the prey. And it is so dazzling. This documentary is one, it is a must see.
Taking our place as a kind of shabby Columbo-like detective. Who gets a Southern detective?
It's great,
and he gets on the trail of this, and so it's worth seeing.
It's definitely worth seeing.
I'm talking about eccentrics.
Oh, Queen of Versailles! Queen of Versailles. This movie. What can you say about this?
Well, some people have heard of David Siegel.
Okay, so let's just take a listen to it. So just to give you a taste of what we're talking about.
I like to have a bowling alley. And then he says, I want a health spot. And then I said, we need maid's quarters. I forgot how many kitchens. 10 kitchens.
10 kitchens, John?
David Siegel is the billionaire president and CEO of Westgate Resorts.
So he sold dreams, really, yes. to millions of people all about timeshares. And this is, I mean, this really, in a nutshell, this documentary shows what happened with the housing crisis, with the mortgage, when mortgages and lending money, everything dried up.
Even to David Siegel himself.
Even to David Siegel.
Yeah. While he is flourishing, the documentary is running, and he and his wife are building the largest
it's the largest
in the country
house in the yeah. yeah
and Jackie is trash.
Jackie is the wife
with heart, but a former beauty queen,
and the relationship these two have. So again, I know I keep saying this, but if you haven't seen The Queen of Versailles, you need to. We John and I have very different takes on this. John thought this was kind of funny.
Yes.
I thought this was deeply sad.
I do agree with you, and as it turns out, I mean, she's.
But
just
you could laugh at it, whereas I could not find the humor in this
trophy wife
because it was so pathetic. Here's this woman who has really clueless. When you say clueless, she has no clue, but she does. There's almost a mental illness aspect of this, and I hate to say that because people in the in the mental health community always hate when you try to label people. But after you watch this, you see there's something wrong and there's something missing from this woman's life that she stockpiles everything. I mean, these are people
including children. She has 8 children. She says she wouldn't have if they couldn't have nannies.
I mean, and the dogs and she has so many dogs, things.
Poop
it's like
in the house.
It's disgusting. Here's this family who has so much money and they treat everything like crap.
The term nouveau riche comes to my mind.
Yeah. And here's David Siegel who sits, he's made himself a throne. And he doesn't want to have anything to do with his family. He's constantly, when the economy crashes and he's in complete crisis mode, there's a range of emotions that go on when you're watching this documentary. So the economy crashes, he's in crisis mode, and you feel for the guy because as much of a jerk as he is and kind of callous person as he is to his wife and to his family, he has no one to relate to. His whole life is built on shallow, superficial relationships. He doesn't have a relationship with his son who works with him in his company. He doesn't have a relationship with his wife. His relationship with his wife is based on her spending his money. And he's all alone. And all he wants to do is be left alone. He doesn't want to see his kids. He doesn't want to talk to anyone. And I will say, this, while it's an exaggerated version, I mean, it's true, but obviously most people's lives are not losing a bajillion, gajillion dollar home. It really showed what was happening in living rooms and families across the country during that time.
It's the cheap money trap. While you might feel good about being superior to them in taste, for instance, you can't feel superior to them about their handling of money.
Because all of us.
And this is
the way of America. Yeah. You borrow because it's cheap.
Yeah.
And we've all been told to do that. We've all been kind of conditioned that's just the way of life. This doesn't happen in other countries, but here I'm to blame too. Right now I've got some credit card debt and you think, oh, I'll pay it off. I'll pay it off when I get my tax refund. I'll pay it off. But for this family, things are really tough. And I think the interesting part about this too is after the movie came out, there was controversy because David Siegel did not like the way he was portrayed or his wife was portrayed. They said they were playing it up for the cameras, that she was acting callous and kind of foolish for the cameras, and that he was mostly upset about the fact that he wanted everyone to know that he was still wealthy.
Sure.
That he wasn't going to get rid of that house and he was just fine. So he was still worried about people knowing.
Oh, yeah. But I think the real fun part of this film is Jackie. And when you see that they are going down financially, she's still out at Walmart with carts and carts.
And the
toys.
I mean, she's buying her kids bikes for Christmas and things. And you look in the garage and you see they've already got each one of them 5 bicycles. And the heartbreaking part is the nannies.
Yeah. Yeah. They have some international nannies. And
who've left their families to take care of this family.
And they are caring about it.
And this nanny lives in the playhouse. Ugh, you have to see Queen of Versailles if you haven't. It's actually up for, I'm sure, a Golden Globe for documentary, and it will be for Academy Awards,
now,
I can bet you.
Let's do something a little less real.
Okay.
And let's talk about make-believe.
Ah, make-believe was one of my favorites of the year.
This is really about making magic.
Making magic. Yeah. And I think I said earlier that this really goes hand in hand with Bully, because here are the same kind of kids who probably would be bullied, you would think, because this follows a group of teenagers who are really into magic. They want to be the next Lance Burton.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I pulled that out of my hat.
Whoa.
Da-dun-dun-tsh. So... And they're getting ready to compete for this Lance Burton teen competition.
The teen world champion.
The teen world champion.
The world magic show competition.
Right. And they are...
In Vegas, appropriately.
And it follows all of these different teenagers from different parts of the country, some from different parts in the world. And they all have one goal, and it's to make magic and to be the next star.
And they're developing unique acts. That's the very creative part of this. Each one of them has a different way of approaching magic. So you have Kristen Lambert, the blonde.
Right, from Los Angeles.
American, yeah, just
very
a cute
bright
kid.
But privileged, and she has all access. She belongs to the magic
She's got a big smile. Then there's Bill Koch, who is devoted to excellence.
Well, yes, and this is his last year to compete. So let's take a listen as he is creating something that I thought was great. I mean, these kids do everything, and you can see in this clip we're going to play for you. He's creating the accessories for his big show.
It's like a photographer looking at a shot of a bird mid-flight and being like, no, 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 that's the one. That's the one that I'm going to make my career with. This is the shot that's going to make me famous.
So you can hear just from listening to this kid, Bill, that this is life for these kids. So the amount of hours they devote, which I thought was incredible. And it's every kid in this movie is so sweet. They're these type of kids that you just hope your child is like, the devotion to something they love. And you know, the underbelly of this, though, is these are kids who are lonely, who really had, you can tell, don't have much to relate to other kids who are their age. They're not doing the same thing other kids of their age. And they found magic, and magic has really helped them and given them purpose, which is why I really can see a lot of similarities with Bully.
My angle of vision on this is that it's deficient in showing the downside of everything they have to do to be there. Most documentaries will show you the stress and strain on families, on them, on school, and so on. And you don't get so much of this.
No,
it's pretty upbeat about their creativity.
Right.
What you have to see, as you were suggesting, is that they have sacrificed a great deal in most of what's a normal way of young people living and acting by being the best at what they do.
And I really think that when I saw this, I cried. And you guys, if you listen to the show, you know I cry a lot. But I felt that this was something, magic has been a savior to these kids. Because if not for magic, they probably would be those kids who were bullied. And the isolation to be the best at magic is, and it does show that. But I'm with you. I would have liked it if Make Believe showed a little more.
Sure. And I think it needs to have some caution about it. For even young people who see it and say, I'm going for that. I want to be at the Magic Castle sometime. I want to do this. Well, there's a great deal of work you have to do and sacrifice that you have to make to get there. And the doc doesn't really show that. But boy,
no.
It is, as you said, a very nice contrast to Bully. But then there are a couple of documentaries that I'm not sure you have seen.
No, I have not seen Chasing Ice, but I've heard about it.
Right. And Chasing Ice is just an extraordinary documentary about global warming, that a little bit like Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth.
I was going to ask you. Okay.
Yeah, gives you images. This is a filmmaker who has set up cameras in the Arctic,
mm-hmm.
and they're going 24 hours a day, days on end.
So you can see the progress.
You can see that, and there is one calving, as you know. This is when the ice breaks off of the icebergs, and there's one that breaks off the size of Lower Manhattan.
Oh, my goodness.
So it is an amazing sight through these cameras.
So like Samsara, it's all visually.
Oh, it is. And there is one part where you do have the illustrations, just as Al Gore did. This is much more visceral than Al Gore's. It's much, they're out there. They've got the clamps on their boots, and they're fighting the ice to get these shots. But there's one illustration about the size of the glacier and its recession for 100 years, and the size of the glacier in its recession of 10 years. And the 10 years equals the 100 years. The last 10 years has taken back the glacier as much as 100 years before that.
That's incredible. So as we wrap up our part about docs, what do you think it is? I was thinking about this while we were preparing for the show. What do you think it is about documentaries that have become so important to filmmaking and to the kind of the genre of film?
Yeah.
It's become really big.
Yeah. You may know that in school curriculums these days, they're going toward having more of an emphasis on nonfiction, which stirs up the pot for like English teachers who believe that fiction is a way of training the mind and preparing for the world with its ambiguity. And the other side, which says, no, we need them to read more texts that are based in fact. And I think documentaries do the same thing. We have so much good fiction out there in film that they serve as a kind of antidote to that, bring you back down to reality. We've always loved it, but films are just doing it very well. When you get to somebody like Michael Moore, here's where I really love documentaries. Where is the way the documentarian looks at this subject? Then you realize, as I do, there is no objectivity. When you pick up a camera, you are no longer objective. And that's the same thing that happened. That's why I love documentaries.
Well, right. And I love that you brought up Michael Moore, because I think for someone like me, Michael Moore has been the gatekeeper almost of documentaries. And I think when he came out with Bowling for Columbine, I was young. And I think that really kind of got people interested in documentaries. And without a Michael Moore making documentaries and making documentaries more mainstream, I don't know if so many documentaries would have their place right now in theaters. Because these, you know, typically documentaries are things that you don't really see. They don't get on the, they really get played maybe for like a week and then they're gone. And I know maybe in Columbus that's the case, but I know across the country, if you look at New York and Los Angeles, these documentaries, I think Queen of Versailles is still playing in Los Angeles, and there are people still going to see these movies, because I think with reality TV especially too, documentaries have a huge place, and I think it's always great to be able to leave a movie and learn something. And I think you can when you examine other people's lives and they're real, and it gives us a better understanding of the world and who we are and how we fit into it and what other people are doing in other parts of the country. So I think I love them, and I'm excited to see next year's crop of documentaries, because I know there's going to be another really great list of films.
Carolyn, don't you think we should give our audience a break?
I mean, I think if they haven't given themselves a break already. Right. Yeah, but so let's give them a trivia question, though, okay, so they have something to come back to.
Yes.
So this is we're going on to Dead Dudes, and I promise you this is going to be a much less intellectual conversation. So how about this? Which nearly dead dude just received a Golden Globe nomination for his scene-stealing portrayal of a Hollywood heavyweight? Which one?
We'll be back.
So when we last left you, we asked you a little trivia question. Which nearly dead dude just received a Golden Globe nomination for his scene-stealing portrayal of a Hollywood heavyweight? The answer is Alan Arkin.
A 78-year-old Alan Arkin.
He's 78. He has 5 movies already on the schedule coming out over the next few years. He is 78. He is not slowing down one bit. And the Golden Globe nom is for his... He is awesome in Argo.
Argo is an awesome film. And of course, it's up for nominations, as it well should be. And his part is really just a few minutes, but it's so impressive. It reminds me of Little Miss Sunshine, right?
Exactly,
yeah.
Right.
When he steps on the scene, he just takes over.
And I think that's what's so interesting about this is, you know, you look back how John and I came up with this whole Docs and Dead Dudes, just as a reminder, nearly dead dudes. Obviously, tongue-in-cheek. We aren't wishing ill will on anybody, but at the age 78, like Alan Arkin, when you are still making movies and the chutzpah, as my grandmother used to say, he comes onto the scene, and every scene he's in, he steals it. And by the way, in this movie Argo, which of course is about the 1979 hostages in Iran, and they come up with this scheme to get the Americans out of Iran by making this fake movie, Alan Arkin, most of his scenes, if not all of his scenes, are with John Goodman, who, by the way, isn't any shabby actor himself.
No, tough for Goodman, because he's always playing the lightweight, giving you a little bit of comic relief.
Exactly,
so it's very tough to play against.
And I think Argo, by the way, we talked about the nomination for Alan Arkin, but Ben Affleck, he's directed and starred in this movie, but he's nominated for Best Director for a Golden Globe.
Yeah. Now, listen, I want to caution our audience. We are well aware that nearly dead dudeses or duchesses do exist this year.
Oh, correct.
For instance, Helen Mirren.
Judi Dench.
Right.
For our purposes of, you and I are just English literature junkies, so we like the alliteration, nearly dead dudes.
Right, and
it just
we're aware, and we someday may do that distaff side. But right now, there seem to be a plethora of
old
guides who are still going.
And that's what I think is so cool, because if you look at the list of guys who we're going to talk about, so we have Alan Arkin here, but...
How about the big one at 80?
Are you talking about Clint?
I am talking Clint Eastwood.
Okay, so let's just get into Clint Eastwood right away. Let's take a listen, actually, to his movie, Trouble with the Curve.
Need some money for some new clothes?
I just came from yoga.
You're into that voodoo, huh?
When I first saw Trouble with the Curve.
Yeah, it's a baseball movie. He's playing a scout, and he's there with Amy Adams, his daughter.
Right. I was really harsh on it. This was not really a movie that he put his heart and soul into.
No, sure.
But I think his last real effort was Gran Torino.
Sure. And he's much like his Gran Torino character. He's crusty.
Right.
Set in his ways, but with a little glint in his eye. So it's not bad, but it's not great, Eastwood. But what is reminding us is that he's still a viable Hollywood star. And when you saw his star turn on the stage for Romney.
The Republican National Convention.
Yes, at the convention.
That was
realize,
a low point.
But you realize how powerful an image he is.
Oh, yeah. He trumped the presidential nominee. Sure.
And to think he's married to...
Oh, the reality
from California.
The reality TV person?
No, no. Well, yes, she is. But she was formerly a television news commentator.
Oh.
In California.
Well, he's a smart
man. A reporter. She was formerly a reporter. Yeah.
But really, if you think about Clint Eastwood and Clint Eastwood's career, just like Clint Eastwood equals America. He's sure. This symbol, this icon, and at 80 years old, it can't be any easy feat to do a movie. A movie is not it's a rough kind of day in, day out, harsh thing. And I was a little harsh on Trouble with the Curve, but
oh, listen,
he did his thing.
Here's a guy who wore the same poncho without ever having washed it in all three of his Man with No Name westerns. This is indeed an icon.
That stinks. You mean he's a guy who likes to stink? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
But also a guy whose favorite actor is, you'd never guess this, James Cagney.
Is his favorite actor. Well, that kind of makes sense to me.
There's something about that, and he's a jazz pianist and who often composes and plays music for his films. I mean, this is one talented dude.
Yeah, but you think about, to think of him ending his career as an actor, and who knows, that might not be the case, but it seemed like he was done already through midway through Trouble with the Curve. You think it seems he thought to himself, I don't really know if I should have done this movie. It's kind of a shame to me for him to end his acting career with Trouble with the Curve. So I do hope he comes out with something else that's not only him as the actor, but also as the director, because I think that's where Clint Eastwood shines.
We'll have to wait a year.
Right, is where he's behind the camera and in front of the camera.
At the end of this year,
right,
he will undoubtedly come through somewhere in December with a terrific film that'll be up for a nomination. But we'll have to wait for that.
Well, yeah. But you know what, John? Clint Eastwood at 80, you think he's the oldest one on our list?
Well, but you know, you brought up somebody that I haven't thought of who might be dead this time next year.
Don't say that. We hope he's not.
But this is Mark Twain at Lincoln.
Oh, yeah. let me just say this. So we're talking about Hal Holbrook at 87 years old for Lincoln. He plays Preston Blair in the movie Lincoln. He's an advisor to Lincoln. I was thinking about this morning as I'm getting ready for the show. I think, gosh, Lincoln is like, I think everyone in Lincoln is a nearly dead dude almost. I think the prerequisite, besides the two young kids who play kids, is you had to be like over the age of...
Yeah, but we have Tommy Lee Jones.
Tommy Lee Jones is in his 60s, so he... Yeah,
66.
So is he a nearly dead
he's
dude?
He's not a nearly dead dude.
He
is.
He deserves some praise.
He's the B-team.
He's a young whippersnapper.
Very much so. But Hal Holbrook has been playing Mark Twain on the circuit for ages, and he's brilliant.
So he is Mark Twain, basically.
Yes, he is Mark Twain. And now, in this movie, he lends a certain gravitas, kind of a bookend with Tommy Lee Jones. But I think he's impressive. His head of hair is impressive. His voice is impressive.
His head of hair?
Right. All of these superficial things. But... he is, in effect, still a very fine and impressive actor.
I remember him on Designing Women.
No, because you know me and TV.
Oh, you and TV don't mix. Right, I am like Mike TV. Right, I love TV. Right. And I just think he again, just like Alan Arkin, has this. And it's not because of age, because certainly there are old actors who stink up the screen. This guy... does not. There is a certain presence and a certain depth. I don't know if it has to do with the fact that, hey, they've been doing it for so long that they know. Watching guys like this, like, you know, like the Clint Eastwoods, the Alan Arkins, the Hal Holbrook, you see when they're not talking is when they're so effective. Not when they have lines, but their looks, their attention, their focus on
this
the craft.
This is the professional side, the people who have been around. I agree with you. And I watch them frequently for their reactions when they're not talking.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great point.
You better believe
it. They are in character. Now, there's somebody here who's a little bit different from everyone we've talked about before. He's a little bit like Clint Eastwood in some ways, but he stands out from all the rest. And he's a 77-year-old who's still going strong with a very young wife.
Let's take a look at a clip.
Experience some turbulence. Please keep your seatbelts fastened and make sure all trays are in an upright position.
Great, turbulence, my favorite.
No, you just relax and stop clenching your fists.
I can't unclench when there's turbulence. You know, I'm an atheist. I don't like this. It's bumping. The plane is bumping. I don't
wait
like when
to
it
meet
moves.
Your fiance.
You know, he's a communist.
Is any of the communist party here anymore? No, he's just very, very left.
Hey, listen, I was very left when I was his age, too, but I was never a communist. I couldn't share a bathroom.
And John, you, of course, we're talking about Woody Allen.
Yes.
None other. And I will just put it out there because I think it's important to let people know if we have a bias. I am a huge Woody Allen fan.
So you must have been disappointed in 2012 with To Rome with Love.
Not as disappointed as I was with Mall, Scenes from a Mall. Do you remember that one with Bette Midler?
No.
God, that was painful. Awful. So in comparison, I love everything Woody Allen does.
Yeah.
I think that he is, but is this Vicky Cristina Barcelona or is this Midnight in Paris?
Midnight in Paris is my
This is not those movies.
Test. Right. And if you're expecting that, don't. The good thing about To Rome with Love is that Woody Allen actually plays a character in it, a dad.
You think that's a good thing?
I do. Because anytime he hesitates, I see the person whom everybody else would like to imitate. The character, the diffident character on the screen who's just brilliant as heck, coming out with these thoughts about literature and so on, and his cynicism about the world. I love his character. And even at his age, he's doing well.
I mean, I think he's a gem. And here's a guy who, talk about like still kicking. I was shocked when you told, because we put together these lists ahead of time. Yes. And on your list was Woody Allen.
Yes.
And even though I knew, yeah, Woody Allen came out with a movie this year, because by the way, he basically comes out with a movie a year. Every year, he doesn't just come out with a movie. He writes these movies. He directs. Yes. This guy is brilliant. I don't know if, you know, you could maybe not like his style. You maybe don't like his him for whatever other reason, maybe his personal life and stuff. This guy is brilliant. And I was actually surprised that he was 77 years old because he seems to have such exuberance and such youth. And do you know that he plays the clarinet on a weekly basis?
Yeah, right. He
does. In New York City at the Carlisle?
If you listen to the music at the beginning of To Rome with Love, that's the essential Woody Allen. It's a beautiful, and it may even be a clarinet, but a beautiful jazz composition that catches the lighthearted nature of it. And he did the same thing, I believe, in Paris.
What's your favorite Woody Allen? Do you have a favorite?
Probably is Midnight in Paris.
That's your favorite?
It's probably my favorite, and it goes beyond even Annie Hall, because there's, as a literature major, when you're going meeting some of the icons of literature, and he's actually recreating them, and I know it's all phony, and it's not.
It doesn't matter.
But,
it's so good.
But Ernest Hemingway, it just captures me. And so I thought he did a very lyrical, romantic job with that. It caught all of his love of Europe and great cities.
And that's what he's so good at doing. Yes. He doesn't just write a movie. He writes a love letter to the cities where these movies take place. Can you tell I like him? I think he's the top. Yeah. All right, so I think it's time for another break. Do you want to get a glass of water, maybe?
Yes, let's do that. I think our audience needs to take
needs
a break.
All right, so ponder your favorite Woody Allen movie, and also this trivia question: which nearly dead dude has had a movie out, sometimes multiple movies out, every single year since 1965? Since 1965, a movie out multiple times, multiple movies sometimes, every single year since 1965. Ponder that, and it's movie time. We'll be right back. So when we left you, we asked the question, which nearly dead dude has had a movie out, sometimes multiple movies out, every single year since 1965? Any guesses?
This has got to be one very old dude. That's all I can tell you.
And you are right. It is 79-year-old Michael Caine. So when we were doing our research for this, you know, I went on IMDb, which of course is a film
buff's Bible.
Favorite tool. Right. And I'm looking down. You're scrolling down to see all the movies. And I'm like, oh my goodness. Every single year. And I'm talking sometimes like three or four films a year since 1965. So the movie that made him famous, of course, is Alfie. And I think that was like 65 or six, around
long
the,
ago.
Who knows? It was a long time ago. But this 79-year-old is kicking. He is not stopping anytime soon. And he was, I was actually very disappointed when the Golden Globe nominations came out and he was ignored. Because you and I both agreed, Dark Knight Rises, I thought he was fantastic.
Touching.
Phenomenal. Yeah,
advising Batman.
But Batman was ignored for everything. Why does that happen?
One of the mistakes that Nolan made was putting it out so soon in the year. And I hate to say that because that dooms us to 4 months of really mediocre movies.
Well, yeah, but, and then having to go see everything in December.
exactly. But I don't know how to get around that.
So do you think it's because of the time it was put out, The Dark Knight Rises, or do you think it's because it's a comic book movie.
Well, and some of those have difficulty getting nominations. Some of those.
Because Loop, just like Dark Knight Rises, Looper was completely ignored. Right, and I thought that movie was phenomenal. Yeah. And I'm not one of these, like, I don't like those kind of movies typically. So I thought both of them were Looper better than Dark Knight. But man, Michael Caine, I thought was, he, scene stealer. Yep. There's that, if you've seen the movie, and most of you, I mean, let's face it, everyone's seen that movie, Dark Knight Rises. You know, there's that one scene where he leaves and it just, I cried. And who cries at Batman movies? But it was, he was phenomenal.
Hey, this is an actor who can also do a beautiful voice, as he did in Cars 2.
Yes.
Playing Finn and Romeo and Juliet. And he was also in Inception.
Oh yeah,
and
that was a he was great in that movie.
Yeah.
So he and mind you, he has like a bunch of movies coming out in the coming years as well. So we're not just talking about his career is going to be over. And at 79, you think to yourself, you know what goes through your mind when you're doing a movie every year? Again, movies, as much as, you know, we see the celebrity of it all and they get paid a lot of money and they have these comforts and, you know, they get shuttled around in limousines and all these things, but it's not an easy job on the body. But then you think to yourself, maybe without this kind of effort and vigor of every day going to a set and having something to look forward to, it really is important for the mind and for to remember lines. Yeah. Heck, I can't remember anything.
Yeah, it's so impressive that he's still active, but when you look at what he's doing, you say, why not?
Right.
What could he be doing that could be more fun than that?
Right, being a movie star in his own right, and also having a certain level. I think one of the things that we miss is, too, that the younger movie stars have missed is a certain level of celebrity, but anonymity. And all the guys on our Nearly Dead Dudes list, they all are have such presence and kind of have lived such a private life outside of cameras, which I think it probably helps their longevity.
Would you say that would be true of our next candidate, who is 75 years old? So he's younger than Michael.
He's a youngin. Also in Dark Knight Rises, my man, Morgan Freeman.
Yes.
You know what's interesting, John? So, okay, we're talking about Morgan Freeman, the 75-year-old for Dark Knight. But I was thinking about how do I know? I've known Morgan Freeman my whole life, I feel like. And then all of a sudden I was talking to my mom and my mom said, well, yeah, Carolyn, of course, because he was on Electric Company.
Oh, my.
Electric Company come after Sesame Street.
Wow.
So I grew up with.
Great piece of trivia.
Right. I grew up with Morgan Freeman. Hey, you guys from Electric Company.
And what strikes me in my own reaction to Morgan Freeman is that I'm never aware, in a sense, that he is a prominent black actor. And here's what he said to Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes. He said to him when Wallace made mention of his being African-American, he said, stop talking about it.
Hallelujah.
I'm going to stop calling you a white man, and I'm going to ask you to stop calling me a black man.
I love him.
When asked how, that was when he was asked how to get rid of racism in an interview with Mike Wallace.
Well, yeah, and this is the thing I love about Morgan Freeman. He doesn't necessarily make a point to go out there and tell you what he thinks. But if someone asks him a question, man, he lets you know. And I love his stance. He has such a youthful kind of exuberance about his person outside of the films and also in the films, and the voice. Let's take a listen. Just hear the voice in Dark Knight Rises.
Oh, it has a long, uninteresting Wayne Enterprises designation. I just took to calling it the Bat. Yes, Mr. Wayne, it does come in black.
Carolyn, that voice is the voice of God.
Oh, and Jim Carrey. Are you talking about the Jim Carrey movie? And he can do everything. Morgan Freeman has done, you know, action-adventure movies. He did Dark Knight, of course, dramas, comedies. He was crazy good in Seven as the, you know, kind of cynical detective. But his body of work is amazing.
As great as Michael Caine's voice is, Morgan Freeman strikes me as the perhaps most gifted voice beyond James Earl Jones.
Oh, right. And James Earl Jones is in his 60s, so he hasn't made the list yet. You'll be there soon, James. Isn't he in his 60s?
He seems older than that, but he may not be.
Speaking of 60, looks like, I don't know, 60 Whoa. Looks like in
he's
diapers.
He's a young'un, as you'd say.
In comparison to these next guys on our list.
Oh, boy. Christopher Lee. Now, that's going to be new to some people who are listening, because Christopher Lee is 90 years old.
Holy moly!
Yeah, and he was, to me, the essence of the dark, sinister, bloody, dangerous, what would you call it? The kind of characters that he's always played.
I don't know. He's so old. I don't really know who he is. I can't believe I'm even mentioning that. But I don't. I know him because he's been in these Lord of the Rings movies, right?
Yeah. And he was originally, and you might want to think about him as a variation of Vincent Price. And he was actually born on the same day, the 27th of May, as Vincent Price.
What year? Played,
and this would be 90. Well, let's not do the math. Yeah, it would be 90. And Peter Cushing was another name that you might not be aware of. But all these guys played in like Edgar Allan Poe, Grimm stories.
And now they're getting their new lease on life in these Lord of the Rings movies.
Yeah.
You either love these Lord of the Rings movies or you hate them. Okay, so Christopher Lee's 90. And in comparison to him, we're talking Ian McKellen. He's 73, so there's a big gap.
About Ian McKellen.
But let's listen to Ian McKellen again. As who is he in this Hobbit thing?
He plays Gandalf.
Right. I always forget their names because I'm going to throw it out there. I'm not really a big Lord of the Rings person.
Nor am I, but we have to deal with it.
All right. So let's deal with it and take a listen to Ian McKellen.
This is about your size.
I can't take this.
The blade is of elvish make, which means it will glow blue when orcs or goblins are nearby.
I have never used a sword in my life.
And I hope you never have to. But if you do, remember this. True courage is about knowing not when to take a life, but when to spare one.
You know, John, I like this guy. Ian McKellen.
You know something? He's a Shakespearean trained actor. You can hear it in his voice, but he has such fun playing roles like Gandalf and plays the gay director in Gods and Monsters, and he's already come out as a prominent gay. So, his life is a kind of complete mix of things that are most interesting.
And, you know, I think what is interesting is on our list of people, many of them, as you just mentioned, Morgan Freeman and now Ian McKellen, they've been important to culture. So not just as actors on the screen, but because of their standing in society and because of their role and being so beloved and such well-celebrated and gifted actors, they've been able to do something for society, shed light on important issues. Or Ian McKellen has been very much in the forefront for gay rights and being very comfortable with who he is. And I think that's great. I think to use your celebrity like that is using your celebrity for good. So Ian McKellen, we thank you for that.
And Ian McKellen is so cool that he is very good friends with Monica Lewinsky.
What?
Yes.
He's not good friends with her.
He is, but he's also good friends with Rachel Weisz.
Okay, that's believable. How does he know Monica Lewinsky?
I have no idea.
Those two. Can you imagine seeing them at the pub for a drink? He wears an earring.
Yes.
That's a little fun fact for you.
Yes, yes, yes.
What do you think about these Hobbit movies? I know people who love them are going to listen to me now and say, Carolyn, how dare you? How dare you say such things? But
my take on
the Hobbit, what's your take? People who love them.
There's too many little people crawling all around that screen. There's way too much of New Zealand.
Too many hobbits.
Right. There's way too, and dwarfs and others. Just,
and the hairy feet and the whole thing. So what do you think, though, it is about people who love these movies? Because, okay, so that Hobbit book, which, by the way, it pained me when I had to read it when I was a young kid. They're making not just one movie. I mean, it's not that big of a book.
I know.
They're stretching this out. So what do you think it is about people who love these movies?
I think they're geeky.
That's so mean.
Right? But I do believe that they live for these. And the original is fascinating stuff.
You liked the first Lord of the Rings?
I didn't, because I thought, again, Jackson was emphasizing too much the special effects.
Right.
Brilliant at the visual. So that. And as Americans, we love the visual.
Of course, but we want things to blow up. As Americans, we want the visual things to blow up.
More fighting. There's more set pieces with just little things.
You don't like these little people.
No, I just don't like it. So, but I have to appreciate what he does when he brings this to the screen.
Okay, and the next Hobbit movie, this other guy, Ian Holm, who's 81, could have been on the list this year.
Yes.
However, he's not in this Hobbit.
Yes,
he's
right.
Because we need another Hobbit. So he's going to play the old Bilbo in the other Hobbit. And there's someone else on our list.
Who's
Anthony
that?
Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins. How could I forget Anthony
How could we
Hopkins?
Forget him?
Yes.
And he is devilish as Hitchcock.
Yes.
75.
Yes, he is.
And he's playing opposite Helen Mirren.
Yes, he is.
Who, as you mentioned, could be on our Dudess.
Yes, right. And this Hitchcock, he captures it, he channels it, but he also makes it his own. So don't think you're going just to see somebody imitating that kind of comedy act.
No.
Hitchcock, I believe there is depth here. It is a picture worth seeing. And there, much of what's said in this movie about making Psycho seems to me what I remember from all the reports. So it's accurate.
And not only that, I think this movie focuses mostly on his relationship with his wife, who's played again by Helen Mirren,
yes,
who's so important to the movie making process. And I think, you know, we are kind of, you forget, because as being now, you forget that making a movie and making a horror movie nonetheless nowadays seems so easy. It's people get it. Okay, yeah, you want to slash people up. Understand. Great. Right. Go. Here's the green light. When Alfred Hitchcock did this, this was not mainstream. So let's take a listen as he tries to explain his vision for a film.
All of us harbor dark recesses of violence and horror. Fascinating, isn't it? When the Wisconsin Police Department raided Mr. Gein's farm, they opened the door, and voila, they discovered 10 female heads with the top sawn off. Pass these around, would you, and have a look. Masks of human skin, a pair of lips on a drawstring for a window shade. Oh, yes, in a jug containing human noses.
Is this really going to be your next picture, Mr. Hitchcock?
Well, that is my intention, yes, madam.
Anthony Hopkins in everything he does. He's award-winning. I don't know if it's because when I saw Silence of the Lambs, I was so young and it scared me to death. But I can't get past, every time I see him, all I can think about is Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah. And that's the problem with such an iconic role.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons he scares you and he scares me so much is what he said about playing this. Here's what he said. How do you play Hannibal Lecter? Well, just don't move. Scare people by being still. He's not some monster that's growling and moving around. He's standing still and just moving his head and moving his lips.
And you know, when you see Hitchcock, it's kind of the same thing. There's this weird stillness about the way Anthony Hopkins portrays. It's a stillness. Because I think when someone is moving around and there's some energy about them and things are happening, you feel, it doesn't feel as unsettling as when you see someone being completely still. And he does this, he brings this same kind of stillness and fear factor to his take of Hitchcock.
Yeah. Well, Carolyn, as we wind down,
yes,
on our show, we want to thank that person who stayed with us during this whole time. The person will be rewarded.
Who?
Our one audience member who's still with us.
That's why I was saying who. Hello, 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 hello.
No, but what I wanted to do was have a kind of B team for these nearly dead dudes.
Ones to watch out for.
Right. These are the young kids coming up.
These are the kiddos.
They're in their 60s, led by, talking about eccentric,
oh,
the great Christopher Walken. At 69.
I can't believe he's 69.
I know. Well, he carries himself, of course, because he was a dancer originally.
And you can see evidence of that. If you don't believe John, he's not only Christopher Walken at 69 years old. We want to celebrate him. He's not only a dancer. He is a phenomenal dancer. He's like, he could be on Broadway. So if you don't trust us, Google this. Go on YouTube or Google Fat Boy Slim Christopher Walken.
Oh, good for you.
You will see him and you will not believe it's him dancing. It is him dancing from start to finish. He dances like a ballerina.
Christopher Walken is in two movies last year, The Seven Psychopaths and Last Quartet.
So 69, whippersnapper.
Yeah, and both of those are fine performances. Although I have to say I didn't see Last Quartet, but we have the screener. I have this.
Let's watch it, shall we?
All right. Another one, I've lived for his roles because I just love his persona, and yet he's still a fine actor, is Tommy Lee Jones.
66 years old, and I think Tommy Lee Jones, he
looks 66.
Well, you said it, not
right,
me,
right.
But he gives a performance really of his life.
Oh, he was
in
born
Lincoln,
for,
in Lincoln. Yeah. He is, please.
He plays that.
And
is,
Men in Black.
Yeah. So he's in
comedy and drama.
In Lincoln, he plays a radical Republican who is
an abolitionist.
Yes, an abolitionist. And he has two scenes, one in the legislature and one with a legislator in his office.
And he Golden Globe nominated, and as he should be.
And you'll just smile if you love him, because he was born to play this part.
And there's one particular speech that you and I both love, and you want to stand up in the theater and shout and go, yes, because he's so good. The next one on the list
is...
This was surprising to me.
Yes.
Our friend Kevin Kline.
Yeah, he's a pretty lithe 65.
65 years old, married to Phoebe Cates.
Okay, very good.
I mean, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, what guy doesn't love her from that?
Doesn't always play in the great movies. I didn't like Darling Companion.
You didn't?
No.
But I mean, in Fish Called Wanda, that's an oldie but goodie.
Yes.
Ken is amazing in that.
He is probably the most youthful of everybody on this list.
I would agree.
Except for Mr. Slick.
Oh.
Right.
Your favorite and mine.
Oh, he is. He may even be up for some nominations.
Richard Gere. He is. Richard Gere, 63 years old, Arbitrage.
Oh.
He is up for a Golden Globe for this. Okay, let me just say this. Richard Gere is hot stuff.
Yes.
He is so fun to watch. Yes. He's a beautiful man.
Yes. I remember reading a critic who was talking about just the way he walks and carries himself.
He's got it going on.
Yeah.
Like Butta John. 63, he's youthful.
The kid amongst all of these, and I think one of your favorites.
I kind of think I have a crush on like everyone on this list, to be perfectly honest.
But most of all, I suspect, Liam Neeson.
Oh, do I have something for Liam Neeson. 60 years old.
A fine 60 years old.
And he was in The Gray. And you and I differ on this, but I thought The Gray was one of the best movies of the year.
I really liked The Gray. Again, the problem was it came out at the beginning of 2012.
I know, they shouldn't have done that.
But it's also an action or thriller that you just won't register it. When you look at it, I think it's one of the best crash scenes ever.
I really think had The Gray come out when Arbitrage came out, Liam Neeson would be up for that Golden Globe nomination and not Richard Gere, because I think Liam Neeson's take on this man who is in a dire situation, knows he's going to die in the frozen dead of winter with nothing to save him. He is so good. And he is so cute. And not that cuteness has anything to do with it, but Richard Gere and Liam Neeson, they've got my number.
They do. All right.
I wish they had my number, actually, John.
But in 10 years or less, they're going to be in their 70s.
Well, that couldn't be so bad for me either.
No, and it's not so bad for our nearly dead dudes.
Thank you so much for listening to the hour-long version of Docs and Nearly Dead Dudes. Have a great 2013. We have so much coming up, John.
Yep.
We're only getting better from here.
Got it.
Let's